With your Amex card, entertainment benefits like special ticket access and pre-sales to select can't-miss events while supplies last, make every tap music to your ears.
Hi, my name's Josh. I'm from the podcast The Imperfects, where we interview well-known people who look like they have perfect lives, but like most of us, in fact, all of us, they're often far from it. We interview people like James Clear and Adam Grant.
What do you do with the feeling of being an imposter? It's really tempting to trust your own judgment over other people's. What you're forgetting is that other people see you more objectively. And I think what that means is if multiple people believe in you, it's probably time to believe them.
Search for The Imperfects on the podcast app you're listening on.
Do you love Selena?
Like, really love?
Whether you saw her live, saw the movie as a kid, or saw her looks all over TikTok, there's no shortage of reasons to stan the Queen of Tejano.
And stan we do over three whole episodes of our podcast, Becoming an Icon.
We're reminiscing as lifelong Selena fans, sharing hot takes and telling her story. Listen to Becoming an Icon on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Becoming an Icon.
The Book of Joe podcast is a production of iHeartRadio. Hey there, and welcome back to the Book of Joe podcast with me, Tom Verducci, and of course, Joe Madden. Joe, I'm going to start off by issuing a decree. Does that sound okay? Do you know what a decree is?
I do.
Yeah, it's actually from a Latin word back in the 14th century. Something decided. So I feel like, you know, I should unroll a parchment paper before I announce this. But here's my decree, Joe. You can no longer say it's early in the 2024 baseball season, right? We're coming up to basically the quarter pole of the season, almost 25% of the season being played. And I know it's something that a lot of managers and coaches and players lean on when things aren't going right. It's early. There's a long way to go. It's a marathon, blah, 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 blah. And what I'm seeing, Joe, around baseball is a complete domination by pitching. I mean, it is such a tough hitting environment. And I understand as the weather warms up, as the year goes on, hitting will pick up. But I'm telling you, Joe, from what I'm seeing on a nightly basis here, hitting is really, really challenged. The major league batting average is 239. Will it get better? Yes. Will it get much better? No. I think we're looking at a year, Joe, where pitching is going to continue to dominate. So that's my decree, is that if you're waiting for your team to start busting out, it ain't happening. This is the game that we have right now. I mean, you're watching these games, Joe. You see what is happening to hitting here. It is tough to find real good hitting. I know you've got teams like the Phillies, the Braves, the Dodgers, but overall hitting is down this year and like way down.
I guess there's a variety of factors that have to be involved in something like that. For years, I've been proclaiming that when it comes to data and analytics, it really does sway to the pitcher's favor, whether it's how a pitcher should pitch to certain hitters, the shape of his pitches, et cetera, what this guy's good or bad at. Then on top of that, you place your defense in the right spots because that's where the large sample size is almost infallible. So I think that starts with that right there. There's no question about that. Beyond that, we've talked about the velocity, and now you're talking about teams like Boston that only throw breaking balls. Hitters are constantly in a state of adjusting right now. And again, they're in a reactive moment. They're not proactive. Defense is proactive. Pitchers are proactive. Hitters are reacting to stuff, and the stuff seems to be getting better constantly. What's the answer? I'm not 100% sure what the answer may be. Again, if you could just somehow relegate your power to something that just happens and not attempt to manifest power, because that's what it's all about. Everybody talks about, you know, you win only by the home run, but if you want to hit the ball, you definitely have to make different adaptations internally, mentally, in order to make more contact more consistently. So again, it's part of it, I think, is philosophical. But a big part of it is that pitching and defense have enormous, I think, advantages based on the data analytical game that's being played today. And listen, I've tried for years with that too. For me, as a hitting coach, you just need to be able to teach your hitter to be able to react to different situations. The two-strike approach, I'm still a big believer in that. I don't think it's preached all that much. I think the opposite field is large. I like base hits when it's necessary. We all like the three-run homer. Who doesn't? Earl Weaver talked about it years ago, and he was right. But the pitcher ain't throwing three-run homers, and you're up there trying to hit it. It's not happening, brother. Putting the ball in the game, make the other team execute. you know, the stolen base is becoming more prolific, but it still doesn't necessarily ensure runs. So again, it comes down to, for me, pitchers and defense have all the advantages. Hitters have to concede and attempt to do something else in order to become at least maybe 250 average. And again, putting the ball in play, base hits, opposite field line, things to that nature. Otherwise, it's going to stay the same.
Yeah, there's no way we're getting to 250. I'd love to see that, but that ain't happening. And I got to give you credit, Joe. You were on this early as the information started pouring into the game, and probably now almost a decade. I want to go back to at least 2015. And you're absolutely right. Pitching dictates in baseball. Hitting is reactionary. So, you know, the advantage of information is, to me, so much on the run prevention side. And just since 2015, just the information that pitchers have at their disposal has really, really exploded. And you're seeing pitchers one after another after another. And this is, obviously, we've talked a lot about the injury rates in Major League Baseball. This is with pitchers going down, and there's just so the supply of pitchers with great stuff. Let me just start with throw some numbers at you here just to define what I think is a hitting crisis going on right now. As I mentioned, the batting average this year is 239. Now, there's only been, in the history of this game, going back to the 19th century, there's only been one year where the batting average has been lower. That was 1968. And of course, that was the year, you know, they had to change the rules. They changed the strike zone. They lowered the mound. They said, we got to do something to get more offense back in this game. Hits per game. If you go to a baseball game this year, the average number of hits for a team in a game is 7.99. It's slipped under 8 per game. The only 3 years of baseball history where you would see fewer hits in a game, 1908, 1909, smack in the dead ball era, and again, 1968. Doubles, the lowest rate of doubles since 1989. Slugging percentage, lowest rate since 1992. This goes on and on and on, Joe, where, you know, there's just, I just don't see it happening here. And you're absolutely right. I think we've talked a lot about velocity. The number, the percentage of fastballs actually is going down. And velocity this year is actually a little bit down. And you go back to 2015, it's only up 1 mile per hour. It's not really velocity. It's really the shape of pitches and breaking pitches. Now, velocity, yes, you can't really separate and isolate pitching. You have to look at things used in tandem. You know this, Joe. Sequencing is super important. But just to give you an example, in 2015, pitchers threw 20% breaking balls with an average spin rate of 2193. This year, they're throwing 31% breaking balls, and the spin rate is 300 RPMs higher. To me, again, I don't want to just isolate breaking pitches, but when the breaking pitches are being thrown more often and with more spin, then that to me is a big factor in what's going on. And why are they throwing more? Because in these pitching labs, they can teach guys how to position their hand on the ball and reshape the pitch. You can even shape a pitch based on the batter's swing in the box and where you want to get it. It's so technical now what's happening with breaking pitches that, man, I feel sorry for young kids coming up from the minor leagues and what they're seeing at the major league level.
Yeah, again, it be all that as it may, and it's all true. So what do you do? You just concede. And again, it's the definition of insanity, right? Keep doing the same stuff, expecting a different result. It's a philosophical adaptation for me offensively. And we've talked about this too, and everybody has. Homers win games. That's because nobody knows how to hit anymore, and they can't string together base hits. Yeah, I think it's a philosophical change needs to be had. Contact has to be more sought after. Ball has to be moved. Action on the bases I'm in. But just to sit around and wait for the ball to go over the wall, that's part of the big reason to me with all this swing and miss strikeout is the fact that you are trying to hit the ball far every swing that you take. I remember a couple of years ago, my first year with the Angels in a meeting in the big conference room there talking about the two-strike approach and whatever. And one of the young guns there, when I brought it up, no, I don't want our guys to change their swing with two strikes. I want them to continue to attempt to hit the ball far. They're all Ricky Bobbies. You know, they want to go fast. And to me, that's the problem. That is the problem in a nutshell. I would really, I'd love to be around the group that actually really gets into teaching hitting as it had been taught in the past. Yeah, you're going to have some guys that could power the ball, yes. And I want them to continue to power the ball, yes. But even if they're power hitters, I do like the idea that they know what to do when they get the two strikes. Mm-hmm. Something different. Just a little concession, please, here or there. Move the baseball. You know, I'd be right back to Timmy Salmon. I mean, Timothy would strike out, but Timothy also knew how to downshift. He knew how to accept the walk. He knew how to, would always chase. But then, of course, you'd get to the point, I'm not going to let that happen again. And you stop chasing. I don't know what the overall philosophy is among each team. Of course, I don't. But it just appears to be that, once again, everybody's drinking from the same till, the same well, where we're just going to try to power the ball. And with that, you're going to chase. You're going to chase elevated velocity. You're going to chase strike ball, sliders and curveballs and changeups. And with that, you're still going to get these same kind of numbers that are just not going to get better unless it's a mental adjustment, not a physical adjustment for me.
I think there has to be a more balanced approach. You can't have everybody swinging for home runs. I look at a guy like Stephen Kwan, who's on the IL right now with the Guardians, but love watching him play. He has swung and missed at one fastball in the zone the entire year. He's going to put the ball in play. I want a team of I need balance in my lineup. I can't have everybody swinging to hit the ball out of the park with two strikes. I need a combination of guys who can do that, but I also want guys who can move the baseball and get people in. And I do think there's too much of, that big swing. I've got three swings. They're all going to be big. Mm-hmm. But I will say this, too. I think the biggest problem, if you will, in this hitting crisis is the quality of stuff on the mound. I really believe that. I think it's never been better, and I've been saying that for years. Think about this. I just looked at this today. The percentage of pitches in the strike zone is higher than it's ever been since we started tracking it in 2015. And the batting average on those pitches in the strike zone is lower than it's ever been. So pitchers have the stuff now to get you out in the strike zone. Do they get you to chase? Yes, that's happening too. Highest rate of pitches in the zone since we started tracking this in 2015 and the lowest batting average. That's, to me, an indication of the quality of absolute nastiness that we're seeing on a night-in and night-out basis, including from guys coming in out of the bullpen in the fifth inning.
Right. Well, that's what the Rays, our big thing as we ascended in the 2006 on up range, is that we needed pitchers that can get hitters out in the strike zone. That was the Yankees and the Red Sox at that time. Because they wouldn't chase. They had finite strike zones. They weren't going to go out of it. And if we could not get hitters out within the strike zone, we were not going to beat those teams. So that was something that Andrew and the guys really sought, was that kind of a pitcher. And now you're telling me everybody is that kind of pitcher. And again, does that speak to their stuff just being overwhelmingly great? Which it is. I'm on board with that. Number two, though, again, if Kwan could do it, why can't other people do it? Why can't the downshift? Why can't more emphasis be placed on, the top half of the ball, inner half of the ball, middle off-field approach mentally? And then you permit the speed of the ball dictate where you're going to hit it. Something soft in the zone, you're going to pull it a little bit more. Something hard, it should be middle opposite field. And just work off maybe just a simple philosophy like that in order to get to better contact. Most of the swings and misses velocity-wise are normally going to be under the ball on a pitch within the strike zone. And normally the breaking ball is going to be over the ball when you swing and miss within the strike zone. So it's a re-education, I think. And again, it's not going to happen overnight on the major league level. If, in fact, this appears to be an issue, this is what's got to start in the minor leagues teaching-wise and beyond that in the collegiate ranks, because, after all, the minor leagues have been shrunk so badly that there's not nearly the number of pull of players that we've had in the past in the minor league system. So philosophically speaking, it's got to go back even to the collegiate level and high school level, because honestly, it's hard to change. It's hard to change what you're doing as you get older if you've been doing it for like 5, 6, 7, 10 years. So all this stuff has to be addressed early on, and it has to be rewarded. I've always believed in that. Whatever you want, if you want more contact on the major league level, reward it. Reward it, and that whenever you're going to reward it, that's going to be something financial. So whatever you want to bring to bear, reward it. Reward it financially. Talk about it. Make it important. And then if you do, you're going to see an improvement. You're going to see it by coming out of your mouth as somebody in charge, superior to an inferior conversation. It's going to get better. if you make that attempt. But it has to be a sincere attempt. Everybody's got to believe it's the right thing to do, and everybody's going to jump on board, and then you will see some results. I do believe that.
I'm glad you brought up the minor leagues, Joe, because to me, I think the gap between the minor leagues and the major leagues as a hitter is greater than it's ever been. And I'll tell you why. Minor league hitters, when they're promoted to the major leagues, they're all hitting. I mean, you look at the PCL numbers, and I know the PCL has always been a hitter's league.
Yeah.
ERA is probably over 5 by now. These guys all have OPSs around 1,000. That ain't happening in the big leagues. Why is that? It used to be, and you know this, Joe, man, 2, 3, 4 decades ago, you know, you didn't see big time velocity until you got to the big leagues. Mm-hmm. Now everybody's got velocity. They see velocity. They hit velocity in the minor leagues. To me, the biggest thing is swing decisions. And just the command of breaking pitches in the major leagues to me is so much better than it is in the minor leagues. These guys are overwhelmed in terms of recognizing what their swing decisions are. I think the biggest jump is swing decisions. And I think right now it's so hard for these young players. And part of this is the hype machine that's become, you know, the prospect coverage. Everybody coming up is the next Willie Mays and Mickey Mantle. There's so much attention on them. The expectation's so high. We're seeing a ton of young players get to the big leagues now and failing. I mean, badly. And I really do believe it's swing decisions. It's so hard to get to the big leagues knowing you're going to see a ton of breaking pitches in the zone and sometimes out of the zone, and deciding what to swing at and what not to swing at. It's so hard for a young player. I think right now for a young hitter, and especially for hitting coaches, man, the climate has never been harder.
I'm waiting for, and maybe it's already happening. You probably have seen this as I haven't had a chance to, bringing the breaking ball machine out for batting practice. I mean, for years, all we've ever done is have a coach stand a little bit shorter on the mound on the bottom of the slope. And all he attempts to do is throw a nice little cookie down the middle, probably 60 to 65 miles an hour. And hitters always talking about timing, which is important. But with all the machines that are available to us now, and they're portable, they get out there very quickly and easily. They can be transported while you're on the road, or maybe even each team supplies it for the team coming in, something to that effect. But I'm waiting to see more of that happening on the field more consistently. Because after all, like if I'm playing the Red Sox right now, based on what we talked about last week, I would really make a big push to get the breaking ball machine out there for batting practice and just get it in your head, watching the spin. And I always set it up two ways. I would set up the ball strike pitch, and I would set up the strike ball pitch. I remember J.R. Phillips, really good left-handed, young left-handed hitter I had with the Angels, susceptible to chasing underneath him left-handed from a right-handed breaking ball. I'd set the machine up to throw a ball. And I want him to track a ball. I want him to not swing at this pitch. I want you to track the ball, see the spin, see where it starts, and know when not to swing. Sometimes your better decisions to be made are decisions to not do something. So I'm curious if that's part of the landscape now or not. If it's not, I'm playing the Red Sox, brother. I'm bringing out a breaking ball machine.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Joe. I've seen it occasionally, and generally it's been maybe just a couple of players, not a whole group, where they bring that machine out on the actual field. So much that goes on now happens in the cages, because every team now has just tremendous facilities underneath. And they actually have these pitching machines now, and they cost about $500,000, if not more, where you can actually dial up the exact spin and shape of that breaking ball that you're seeing that night. If you want to see Cutter Crawford's sweeper, you can just dial it up. There's actually, in the most advanced machine now, there's a video image of Cutter Crawford or whoever started your pitching that night that's actually on the screen. And the release point, his particular release point, that's where the ball is going to come out of. And if he has a lower release point on the sweeper, it'll change to mimic that. It's amazing the way that they can actually, with technology, pretty much copy, clone, if you will, the actual pitch shape that you're going to see that night. And there's a lot of guys who will go in there, or in some do it with virtual reality. They'll put the headset on and see that pitch over and over and over again. It ain't helping. These pitchers still have the advantage. The technology, and you said this to start out, Joe, it's helping run prevention a whole lot more than it is run production.
Last point on that one. I am a big proponent of, you know, staying off your feet. I like the idea of guys using the cage during the season to not be standing out there the whole time, especially on a hot day, especially on a day game after a night game. I'm okay with them hitting inside. I've never been against that, and it's been very successful. However, I do believe the breaking ball, I would hit that on the field. I think it's different. I think it's different on the field when you get out there actually in space and time, you know, with the turtle there, the batting cage itself. But otherwise, you got all this huge backdrop, background, which is different. It's like shooting a bat when you play basketball in high school or whatever, and you have this small gym, and all of a sudden you go to an arena, and where do I shoot this ball? It's like a pea in the ocean. Where does this go? I like the idea of hitting breaking ball on the field. That would be the difference for me, as opposed to inside. I just think it sets up differently mentally, and you could actually see your ability. I'm just going to shoot the ball between first and second. I'm right-handed hitter. I'm going to stay on this sucker. I'm going to let it travel. I'm going right there. And I do believe, this is my opinion, that under these circumstances, if I want to teach a guy to hit a breaking ball better, I'm going to do it the breaking ball machine on the field often. Because what happens is they do it sporadically. Every once in a while, I'm good. It's like when you practice something in spring training, different plays, and all of a sudden you don't use the play at all until like June. And then you put it on and you screw it up and everybody's going, whoa, we did that in spring training. That was like months ago, brother. So this is one thing, based on everything you're telling me, and I haven't been there in a bit, but that would be the one thing I would push my early work assignment, especially breaking ball machine on the field, different guys coming out on a daily basis. And really, let's work on this where we can see it and feel it in real time, real distances. I think I'd like to see how that would work out.
Hey, we're going to take a quick break right here on the Book of Job podcast. We get back, I want to continue our deep dive into the state of hitting, the sad state of hitting in the big leagues. And I also want to ask Joe about two of his former hitters, Javi Baez and Mike Trout. We'll do that right after this.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. People don't always realize just how much their negative thoughts and experiences stick with them and weigh them down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mom does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapist anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Book of Joe today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Book of Joe.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Calling all men. When was the last time you had a really good cry? A recent survey found that women cry on average 5 times a month, while men cry on average only once a month. Studies have shown that crying can support your mental, your physical, and your emotional health. I'm Radhi Devlukia, and on my podcast, A Really Good Cry, we push against typical societal norms. We embrace the real, the messy, and the beautiful, providing a space for raw, unfiltered conversations that celebrate vulnerability and allow you to tune in to share, connect, and find comfort together.
Our tears come as a way to let us release what we can't hold anymore.
And I trust that no one's ever going to find out those deepest, darkest secrets.
Yeah. It's been a hard day. She walks out, and this is what she looks like.
Oh my gosh, give her an Oscar.
Listen to A Really Good Cry with me, Radhi Devlukia, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Book of Joe podcast. We've been talking about the state of hitting in Major League Baseball, and we're getting to a crisis point here, a pitching-dominated game. There are 9 teams Nine teams, almost a third of major league teams, are hitting no better than 227 so far the 2024 season. The White Sox, the Reds, which is surprising, the Cardinals, who are absolutely terrible, the Oakland A's, the Seattle Mariners, who are actually in first place, Detroit Tigers, Pittsburgh Pirates, Toronto Blue Jays, and Miami Marlins. Now, the number of players who are hitting under 200 qualified, that means they have at least, 3.1 plate appearances per game played. So qualified hitters hitting under 200 is 18. That's tied for the most. And I realize it probably won't end this way, but just to give you perspective on how unusual that number is, it's tied for the most in the season since 1884. The most since 1885 has been 9 players hitting under 200. And that happened during the war in 1944. So you had a lot of guys just filling in because a lot of the better players were doing service for their country. And just to give you an idea, some of the players hitting under 200 this deep into a season, again, almost a quarter of the way through the season, Randy Arozarena, Bo Bichette, Andrew Benintendi, Nick Castellanos, Matt Olson. These are really good players. Will they finish under 200? No, but the point is, this is very common now. If you see a hitter now in the big leagues who's hitting 239, you're like, oh, that guy's got to pick it up, right? That's actually pretty good in today's game. You have to readjust your sights, people, and stop getting on guys who are hitting 239 because that's keeping your head above water. It's just crazy. And that brings me to Javi Baez, Joe. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's still the same hitter where you can just flip the slider on the outside part of the plate off the plate. He's going to chase it. Nobody sees more pitches out of the strike zone because he's going to keep swinging at it. And here's my theory, Joe, and you know him really well. I think the changes of the game have really hurt Javi Baez because when he was young, he got by on almost pure athleticism, incredible bat speed. He was as good of an opposite field hitter as anybody I saw, especially on fastballs. That's all gone now. And I think the way the game has changed with all the spin here, they're just carving him up. If you've got a flaw in today's game, first of all, they know it on the day you get to the big leagues because they have the data from the minor leagues. And they're getting him out the same way time and time again. And I think just the way the game is now, it's really conspired against hitters like Javi Baez, who just don't have a really good specific plan at the plate. Joe, you know him well. Mm-hmm. We've talked about his baseball IQ, such a smart player. He's still one of the best defenders and taggers that you can actually see anywhere in the middle infield. But offensively, man, it's tough watching this guy get out the same way night in, night out.
Yeah, we went through it in spurts in Chicago. And my way with Javi was I would call him in the office and we'd have a discussion. And I would just, and I'm sure they've done it there, but I would sit there and recap what's going on and then give him my thoughts. And you've already touched on it. And it's true. I mean, he has to think right center first. He's a perfect example of let the speed of the ball dictate where you're going to hit it. And furthermore, with him, he's got to, and for as much as it's antithetical to him, he's got to take power out of his head. And he's just really, he's one of those guys that has to think single up the middle or the right center field gap or even down a right field line first. And then work it off that. I don't know to what extent they've done it, but he's got this, I used to say he's got the John Daly swing. Mm. He had this big old wrapped it around the back of his head swing. And when he would time it up, it would, you know, be a beautiful thing. He hits the ball really far in batting practice. He's fun to watch because, again, think about it as a golfer. If you really take that big swing and wrap it behind your head like that, in golf, you want to be a little bit more accurate. But him, he doesn't matter where he hits it. He just has to hit it as hard and far as he can, and he would. So I at some point, he's got to have to make a mechanical adjustment. He's got to cut it down. He's got to shorten that up. He's got to have a completely different thought process. But that's not easy to do for him right now and where he's at in his career. But that I believe that. And it's got to be middle of the field like you've suggested. It's got to be, and again, a perfect example, breaking ball pitched for a ball. Set it up. Watch this because he sees it in the game, and I know he knows. But this would be a one-on-one thing too. It would not be the bunch of people watching. This is kind of situation for me with a hitter, a player that's really struggling. I used to like to get him out early when nobody else was around. And we'd go over stuff because sometimes guys are actually embarrassed by that. They'll never admit it, but they are. So when you want to make a deep dive adjustment, get him out with nobody else around. And it could be almost every day. Like, what is it, 20? They always said 21 consecutive days in order to break a habit or create a new one by doing something differently. This something requires like that kind of an approach. And it would require, a total buy-in from the player. So that's my thought with that. And I'll tell you another thing. This might sound nuts, and it might be a little bit too late, but I think Maury Wells did it. This guy can hit left-handed. He could really hit left-handed. He's that good of an athlete, or at least take more batting practice left-handed. I'm a big believer in that. Just do things differently in order to see differently, to feel differently, to visualize differently. It requires a unique kind of a strategy to get him out of where he's at right now and into something differently. All those things, I would just make it wide open. But to work with him would be, if it's a 7 o'clock game and it's at home, it probably or would be about 2 o'clock on the field.
Yeah. By the way, I like the idea. I've seen him swing left-handed. Even if it's a batting practice situation, you almost want to shock the mind and do something completely different to get out of this rut that you're in. And also, I should point out, he's had a bulky lower back issue too. I mean, a lot of times he won't play the day game after a night game. He's lost explosiveness and he's not the same athlete. Still a really good one, but that explosiveness still isn't there. By the way, when I look at this Detroit Tigers team, and they're a good example to me of what's happening in the game, their pitching is really, really good. And it's being wasted because their offense is just, it's awful. Baez has been, pushed way down to the order, hitting eighth. He's pretty much almost an automatic out because you don't need to throw him strikes. And they have a lot of young players, Joe, that just on the major league level, they're just getting overwhelmed. Colt Keith and Parker Meadows and Kerry Carpenter. And then there's Spencer Torkelson. He was the number one overall pick in the draft. He had a really good year last year. He started slow and came on, hit some home runs late, looked like, okay, this is the guy that you saw when you drafted him, 1-1. And I see the guy now, Joe, and he's lost as well. And what I don't like is he creates absolutely no rhythm with his hands. He is hitting under 200 on fastballs, getting beat consistently on fastballs, late on fastballs, out front on breaking pitches. His pull rate actually is sky high. It's over 50% because he's pulling off speed pitches. And Joe, that's the worst place to be in as a hitter, where your timing is so messed up. You're late on fastballs and you're early on off speed. And that's where he is. And it reminds me of Cody Bellinger when he first came up. He moved nothing in his hands until the ball was actually released by the pitcher. Good enough athlete, great bat speed to get away with that for a while. Eventually caught up with him, and he's made some changes. I think that's where Spencer Torkelson is at. I see this guy hitting with this upright posture. He's really big on mechanics and trying to be as balanced and as quiet as possible. But there's nothing happening with rhythm in terms of his hands and getting that bat started before the ball's out of the pitcher's hand. And again, he's doing that from an upright position. So there's nothing engaged. Chili Davis once told me, and he's a great hitting coach, you always need to be gaining on velocity. You can't wait on velocity. You've got to get yourself set, get some rhythm going in it. And I think Spencer Torkelson, with no home runs, just getting overwhelmed on velocity, he's a guy, and I know he's big on process, and a lot of these hitters rely a lot on process. But the big league's about results, man. And he's another guy. I would get him back in the lab and try something different, create some rhythm in the batter's box.
Wow, there's a lot to unpack there. Just a couple of quick notes from me. Number one, he's definitely in the maybe mode. Sounds to me like he's guessing. Darren Erstad would get like that sometimes. And I said, Erstie, you're in the maybe mode, where it's maybe a fastball, maybe it's a breaking ball. To me, when you get in a maybe mode, you got to narrow it down and make it always one thing. And for me, I always prefer fastball. If your mind is not set mentally to whatever that velocity could be, there's no way you're going to catch up to it. You can't. And if the breaking ball gets so embedded, you're worried about chasing that. And then you have to like split your concentration before the ball's thrown on the breaking ball. Also, no chance. The guy chooses to throw a fastball. There is zero chance you're going to hit that ball like you would like to with any kind of authority. So it sounds like he's absolutely in the maybe mode. And number two, you did mention he's really into his mechanics. And that's our fault. I mean, that really, the advent of mechanics, really teaching mechanics, I tell you exactly when it happens, in the 80s, became a more of a mechanical game when it came to hitting, as opposed to more of a mental game. Because even as a young player in the 70s, I remember going out for early work. And all it was hit the ball. Part of the early work was hit the second baseman in the foot with the line drive. And then from that thought, all your mechanics are set up off of that thought. The ball is going to get deeper. You're going to stay above the ball. You're going to hit the, you know, drive the ball the other way. No fly balls, line drive, hard ground ball. Everything's going to be set up by that one thought. But now in the early 80s, and I'm not blaming anybody, but like when Benny Hines came on or Rick Down came on, and that particular group, Jimmy Lefebvre came on, where they were really good at explaining mechanics. Then that really became more in vogue to discuss mechanics more than the feel of the game necessarily. And I just think, and again, here comes where technologies both could be both good and bad. If you're just so absorbed into the tech of the game and the mechanics of the game, you forget to compete. I remember with KB, Chris Bryant, KB being on deck in the hole, getting ready for his at bat. And I used to like BS with before he went up there, just try to help him out a little bit. But my advice almost 100% of the time to KB was, listen, man, go up there and compete. Go up there and beat that guy. Don't let him beat you. He's trying to keep food off your table. Beat that pitcher, period. Compete with him. So I think we don't teach compete. We teach everything but compete. We rely so much on the mechanics of the game in order to get us by that sometimes you forget to just go out there and play West Hazleton, and you want to beat West Hazleton. You know why? Because they had a different uniform on and you hated them even though you didn't know why. I mean, it really comes down to that sometimes too. And I don't know that players rely on that enough. I'm going to beat you. You're on the other team. I don't like you. I'm going to beat you. And I still believe that there's some power in that thought also. So these are the kind of things to me as a coach, if a guy's struggling that badly, and even say for Javi as an example, I would try to get him out of the maybe mode. Let's set on one thing right here. And let's get more into the mental approach. Like, you want to talk process routine? How do you walk up to the plate? Todd Green, Jackie Snow, I'd have them squeeze the bat as they went up to the plate. Squeeze it, squeeze it, squeeze it, squeeze it. The moment the head of the bat touched home plate, relax. You don't know what relaxes until you know what tight is, as an example. The breath. Another thing with Todd Green, I have him look at, or Jackie, it was Jackie. Look at the label on the bat, the Louisville Slugger label, whatever it was at that time. And when you looked at that before you got in the box, that meant middle of the field. That meant middle. That's all I wanted them to focus on was middle. So you would do little things like that to get them off of the mechanics. And then you could react. Because, brother, with the way the ball's being thrown right now, if you have any mechanical noise going on, you're not going to be able to react. And any kind of teaching or learning you have to do before the game, if you want to work off a tee, soft toss, whatever, fine. But once you get into that game, brother, it's got to be see ball, hit ball, and you got to train yourself to do that also. Long answer, but I don't even know to what extent some of these guys are really paying attention to that. Or are they so absorbed in their physical mechanics?
It's a great point. I mean, as you know, the batter's box in a game situation is not the place to be thinking at all about mechanics. That's the time to be an athlete and, as you said, to compete. I just think today's hitter, based on the way pitching and stuff is so good, to me, Joe, you have to pick out one approach. You've got guys in the batter's box. If you think you're trying to cover everything, you are going to get buried by the game today. And generally, it's going to be fastballs. You get a fastball to hit, you can't miss it in today's game. So you better be ready for it. Now, there are times with some guys, especially relief pitchers, are going to throw their slider 75% of the time. You've got to look for that. But for a hitter to step in the box, think about mechanics, or to think about covering every single pitch, no, you're done. I mentioned Mike Trout. And Mike Trout is the guy, his batting average has suffered. And, you know, he's become a slugger. There's more swing and miss in his game as well. But now he's not able to play. Mike Trout just had surgery to repair a torn meniscus. And that's a tricky injury. And those things vary depending on how much of the meniscus was torn. But this is going to be months more so than weeks for Mike Trout. You probably will see him by the end of the year. But it's a tricky rehab process because that, think about the meniscus is pretty much like a gasket in your knee, and 75% of it does not get any blood flow into it. So when they talk about repairing it, most of the times all they're doing is clipping off part of it. It does not repair itself. He's going to be fine, but the rehab process is really long. It's actually, if you actually take the whole thing out, the rehab process is shorter. But anyway, this is another year for Mike Trout where we're not seeing him play every day. He has not had 500 plate appearances in a season. since 2019. We're talking about 5 years, and I know the first year that was pandemic related, but 5 years where we're not getting to see Mike Trout play on an everyday basis and get 500 plate appearances. It's a shame. If you're an Angels fan, a Mike Trout fan, a lot of people are, obviously it's a shame, but even if you're a baseball fan, it's a true shame, because I'm thinking we're missing a big part of, you know, a Hall of Famer's prime of his career. My question for you, Joe, is Mike Trout at this stage, when he does come back to the Angels, you know, what is he, and can you still play Mike Trout in center field at 33 years old, which he will turn in August, and with this injury history?
Yeah, I mean, those are things that, you know, I was trying to address while I was there, too. I think it would be wise to get him out of center field. We talked about that. It was met with some resistance, but whatever it takes to keep him on the field is what you do. And that would include days off on occasion, just to make sure that he stays rested and possibly, I don't know why. I mean, he's had this propensity to break down, and like a really freaky, like the time he blew out his cap, he's handing Butterfield his helmet and all of a sudden his cap blew out. And from what I understand, the meniscus problem was kind of the same kind of a thing. It was just innocuous, and all of a sudden that was an issue too. So again, I guess I'm contradicting myself, because these situations where he's gotten hurt have not been apparently like a overuse or a difficult moment or an awkward situation. It's just happened. It's just unfortunate. I mean, he is all of that. He is that good. He's a great guy. Probably one of the best bodied baseball players I've ever been around. The guy could have played any sport well. It's a shame. It is a shame. And I don't know. When he comes back, I would guard it a little bit. You know, you still want to treat him like Trout and let him play as often as possible, but I still want to guard it a bit. Whatever it takes, put him in a corner. Just take some of the emphasis off of it. We all at some point have to bury a portion of our egos in order to make adjustments. And it wouldn't be a bad idea at all just to take care of him. The big thing with Mike Trout, if I'm the Angels, I want him on the field. Whatever it takes to keep him on the field, I would do that. And so you described the meniscus component of it. Hopefully that turns out well. But yes, I would do something differently.
Yeah, you brought up the idea. I think it was spring training one year.
Taking
him out of center field.
Everybody lost their mind.
You kicked the hornet's nest with that. Right. My goodness.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, my God. I mean, everybody got involved. And it just seemed like the right thing to do. And it's not positionally. I mean, like Pete Rose moved all over the place. So you could go around a lot of different guys that were pretty good athletes or position players. They moved at some point in their career. It's no big deal. It's for you. It's for you and it's for us. Whether it's when it's for you and for us kind of simultaneously, then that's kind of a win-win. So that's all. That's all that was all about. It's nothing else to do. You know, at that time, Brandon Marsh was available. You know, Joe Adell was ascending a bit. There are other options. The point is, Mike Trout on the field as often as possible. How do we do that? What are the concessions we both have to make to do that? And you do it. Pretty simple for me.
Yeah, and he'll be back, and he'll still be a great player. I mentioned the batting average, but Mike has become just a pure slugger these days. Hits the ball a lot to the pole side, gets the ball in the air. He's going to come back and be dynamic. But as you mentioned, the key is making sure he's out there as much as you can. Mm-hmm. Joe, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, I've got some pet peeves I wanted to bring up. You got any pet peeves? I want you to think about them. And I'm going to ask you if you've got something baseball-related, pet peeve, that'll be your opportunity to get it off your chest right after this.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my! Look at that! He is! And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Calling all men. When was the last time you had a really good cry? A recent survey found that women cry on average 5 times a month, while men cry on average only once a month. Studies have shown that crying can support your mental, your physical, and your emotional health. I'm Radhi Devlukia, and on my podcast, A Really Good Cry, we push against typical societal norms. We embrace the real, the messy, and the beautiful. providing a space for raw, unfiltered conversations that celebrate vulnerability and allow you to tune in, to share, connect, and find comfort together.
Our tears come as a way to let us release what we can't hold anymore.
And I trust that no one's ever going to find out those deepest, darkest secrets.
Yeah, it's been a hard day. She walks out, and this is what she looks like.
Oh my gosh, give her an Oscar!
Listen to A Really Good Cry with me, Radhi Devlukia, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you love Selena?
Like, really love?
Whether you saw her live, saw the movie as a kid, or saw her looks all over TikTok, there's no shortage of reasons to stan the Queen of Tejano.
And stan we do over three whole episodes of our podcast, Becoming an Icon.
We're reminiscing as lifelong Selena fans, sharing hot takes and telling her story. Listen to Becoming an Icon on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Becoming an Icon.
All right, I started this podcast, Joe, talking about decrees, and I said you can no longer say it's early in the baseball season. It's time to start worrying, time to get yourself in gear. If you're one of the 18 players hitting under 200 or one of the nine teams hitting under 227, the season starts running out. Not quickly, but slowly and surely it will. Mm-hmm. I'm going to end it with some pet peeves. And it sounds like, you know, pet peeves are trivial. So I'm not saying these are world issues, Joe. But when announcers talk about a grand slam home run, it bothers me. A grand slam is a home run. That's redundant. You don't need to say grand slam home run. Okay? I mean, get it right. You're in the business of getting the things right in terms of wordsmithing. Just say grand slam. Another one. Revert back. You know, he reverted back to his 2019 form.
Sorry.
Yeah. Revert means you're going back. It's redundant. Don't say revert back. What else do I got here? This is a big one for me, Joe. And announcers say this all the time. I'd love to know the first person who brought this up. Lefties like the ball down and in. When a guy hits a home run on a pitch down and in, inevitably the announcer's going to say he threw it right where lefties like it. First of all, it's not true, people. It is not true. Just as an example, and I've checked this year after year, lefties on the ball down and in are hitting 259. Righties on the ball down and in are hitting 289. And you've got to tell me why it would even be plausible that a left-hander and not a right-hander would like the ball down and in. It doesn't make any sense. Just because he's left-handed, he's a good down and in hitter. That makes no sense, and it's repeated all the time. I'd love to find the first person who said that, because, man, it has spread like wildfire. That's all I got, Joe.
That was an oldie but goodie back in the day. It was a right-handed pitcher throwing the ball, a breaking ball down and in, or fastball down and in, because at that time, lefties were taught to pull the baseball, period. All the former managers, coaches I've been around back in the 70s and 80s, they wanted their lefties to hit the hole. If there's somebody on first base and you're left-hand hitter, obviously, they want you to pull the ball. They want the ball in the hole, because at that time there was not as much sophisticated positioning of the second baseman. He was more in double play depth, so he was up and in over towards the bag. So that hole was gargantuan. So I think part of it is that. Number two, you hit on it. First of all, redundancy is my number one issue in life. People that repeat themselves, my God, it drives me insane. Me and Uncle Eddie, my dad's brother, sat with him one time, avid reader, Uncle Eddie, and he reminded me, Joey, you know what really bothers me more than redundancy? He was a radio announcer, had this great voice. And I said, God, Uncle Eddie, that's me. So yes, redundancy. I heard you the first time. I don't need it being repeated to me. If I do, I'll say, pardon me, I missed that, something like that. But the redundant component, that's like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. So whether it's an announcer or a conversational, somebody thought that they said something funny, I didn't get it, they'll say it again because they want to make sure I got that funny thing. No, I heard it. It wasn't that funny. Number two, the phrases, I know and you know. I know. I know. You know. I had a painting with the Spy versus Spy and Dave Mason, Only You Know and I Know.
Great song
from back in the day. And so I wrote on I Know and You Know, and it came when I put with apologies to Dave Mason. Guys that are always saying I know. And then in 10th grade, world history. Mr. Cebulski, if you said, you know, and in any part of your sentence, if you started or included the phrase, you know, he'd stop you. You know what? So I really try to eradicate that from my method of speech when I'm speaking to people. Those that always say, I know, I don't like that. And those that say, you know, I always try to eradicate that. So those, maybe I'm not talking in a baseball sense, but those are my pet peeves. And number three, apathy. Apathy. You see, like we're talking about things that need to be changed. And a lot of times, you know, it takes, there's a shift, a paradigm shift, or another kind of shift, a tectonic, you have to move some continents in order to get something done or moved. You can't be apathetic. And I think that happens to us way too often. You choose status quo over a course of action, because the course of action requires a lot. It requires a thought, a method. You have to put it in a method of operation. How are we going to get this done? You got to put it into play. You got to follow up. You got to include so many people. Apathy. So redundancy absolutely fries me. People that say, I know, and then they follow it up with, you know, and then eventually apathy drives me crazy.
That's a great call on the you knows, by the way. Great
yeah, right.
call.
Yeah, yeah.
And how about the guy who tells you the story that he's told you 15 times already?
Ugh.
And you feel your body tense up like, oh my goodness, we're going there again. And it's typically a long story. And how do you basically tell the guy, dude, you've told me this before. I know where we're going here. Let's move on. It's awkward.
Well, how many times somebody says, hey, listen, I got a great story for you. And you immediately, you know, I don't want to hear it. I mean, you want to be Larry David in that moment. No, it's okay. I you know, keep your story. But that happens often too, where people always think that what they have to say is interesting. For me, here's my thing. If I'm really having a good conversation with somebody and we're engaged and I really feel like this person's engaged with me, I will give them everything. I will give them everything I got. I mean, I'll unload the vault, everything I think on a particular subject. I'll go, because I think we have a connection or it's interesting. And then there's the others that will ask a question, pretend to be listening. And you know very well that they're not. They're always distracted. They just can't stay in tune with you. I will absolutely truncate that conversation. I'm out. So I'm going to cut it off as quickly as I possibly can. That's a read we all make. So if we're engaged, I'm in. I'll give you all I got. If I know that you're not engaged, I'm going to eject.
Two more for you. The word notoriety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the original meaning of that word was you were noticed because you did something of infamy. It was not a good thing.
Okay.
And we've lost, we're so in love now with celebrity and being known that it doesn't matter whether you're known for something good or bad. People say, oh, he gained notoriety. Like it's a compliment. No, let's use the word properly. And one more for you in a baseball sense, Joe. When people praise a guy for running hard down the line, they'll actually go to a replay and say, look at that hustle. He busted it out of the box. Isn't that what you're supposed to do? Do you need to be patted on the back for actually running hard? I think not.
No, agreed. Those are the things to me that's 101. That's the first meeting of spring training. Absolutely.
Respect 90.
That said, respect 90. And if I have a team that respects 90, I'll take it. We're going to make mistakes. We're going to stink. We're going to lose games. We're going to win games. But if you play the game properly and hard, I mean, like, I hate to jump sports on you, but I've been watching the Knicks. I'm a Knick guy. I'm an Atlanta Hawk fan. I was a St. Louis Hawks fan. Eventually became Atlanta Hawks fan. But my backup team has always been the Knicks in the 70s with Frazier and DeBuscher and Reed and that whole group. So I got this thing. But I'm really enjoying it. I'm watching a kind of a renaissance regarding physicality or caring for four quarters as opposed to just the fourth quarter. I'm enjoying the games. I am. There's times that, you know, the three-pointer gets in the way of execution and stuff. Well, however, like if Jerry West had an opportunity to shoot more three-pointers or a three-pointer, he probably would have done it back in the day, would have taken advantage of it. But I love the effort, man. Man, I'm digging the effort. It's wall-to-wall effort. And that's all you could ever possibly want. That is respect in 90. That is running hard to first base. And my teams, if I get that, I believe my team's going to be competitive. Last point, when you're talking about an announcer, I've seen some of the most routine plays just glorified to the point, like, you got to be kidding me. It's like, I think that we've taught today's announcer to go over the top somehow and become so emphatic about a routine play being made that it kind of annoys me a little bit. It's not unlike running hard to first base. So it's just report the game. I'd like to just see more effort being put into explaining the game better in different situations. The other day I saw a good outfielder. I think it was with the Yankees. The guy that used to, Grisham. Grisham went to the, I think it was him in Baltimore, went to the outfield wall, jumped, and it was in Baltimore, I believe. So yeah, you could reach over the fence and grab it, but he jumped up with his back to the wall. Mm. And when you jump with your back to the wall, you can't jump. The wall stops you. To me, that's a perfect opportunity to describe something like that as a teachable moment for a kid watching the game. So those are the kind of things that I think get left unchecked when an infielder throws on the run constantly. And I know that some guys are really good at it these days, and Longo was outstanding at it. But there's different things I would like to see pointed out. If we want kids to be involved in a game, I want the kids to play the game right. And when it comes to mechanics, so pay more attention to stuff like that as opposed to screaming because a guy dove at a ball that he could have caught standing up.
You know, Joe, I'm glad I got you wound up with pet peeves. You know what I'm talking about? You know,
I do. I got you. I'm feeling you. Well done.
Well, you got something to take us home here, Joe?
Yeah, I do. And I don't know. I don't even know if this applies or not. This always applies, and it does. I saw this the other day. I was reading something, and it was from Steve Jobs. And we're talking about leadership being in empowerment as opposed to control. You know, I would think, not knowing him, I would have thought he would be more of a control kind of a guy. Maybe he was, but this phrase does not indicate that. This is from him. It doesn't make sense to hire smart people and then tell them what to do. We hire smart people so they can tell us what to do. Steve Jobs. That is... wow, that's it. That's perfect. To me, that's how you do it. But I think the chain of command breaks sometimes. I mean, the person at the top being hiring a smart person, the smart person that he hires has to be smart enough to know that the people that he's working with then permit them to do their jobs. At some point, with the chain of command breaks somehow, where at some point people forget that even though I've been permitted this ability to have a kind of like this potential to make impact here by being myself, I have to afford that to the next guy and the next guy, whatever that chain may be. So that I thought was brilliant, and I loved it.
I love that too, and it reminds me of a conversation I had yesterday with Stephen Vogt, who's doing a great job, by the way,
as first-time
manager with the Cleveland Guardians. Not a surprise. Anybody who knows Voter, and you do, I know well, Joe, saw this coming. And one of those players, you say, that guy's going to be a good manager. And I had noticed watching the Guardians play and watching Voter in the dugout, Joe, that he was devoid of any kind of binders or cards or information. And I asked him about that. And he literally uses nothing in the course of a game. You know, obviously a ton of prep work going in. He's paying attention to the game. It's exactly what he told me. He says, I'm watching the game. I'm paying attention. And I also, and this gets back to your Steve Jobs quote, he said, I trust my coaches. Mm-hmm. They're on top of things. I'm trusting them. To me, was such a mature, advanced approach for a guy who's still a first-time manager. He had never managed before. Just the confidence I heard in his voice, the trust that he knows the game and trusts himself and trusts his coaches jumped out at me. In a day and age where guys are looking at the charts on the dugout wall, you know, every 2 seconds, thick binders in the dugout, looking at tablets, you name it. It's an old school approach. And I was just so impressed by listening to Voter talk about that.
Well, that also tells me that he has the support of the front office because they're not trying to force a bunch of stuff on him, because that would normally happen. A first year manager like that, he's going to get normally inundated. Now, I wouldn't doubt that he gets stuff before the game that he studies. Voter's a really smart dude. But I love the idea that you rely on your other people. Of course you do. And that's the only way to do this. But it's interesting that the front office there is permitting that method to be employed. Now, I hate to be the fly in the ointment, but I'm curious as to if they don't do so well, if there's going to be a shift from the methods incorporated from top to bottom. I'm certain Voter's not going to want to change. But these are the things I'm suspect about. So I love it, and I hope they stay there because Voder is sharp. He's really sharp. He's funny. And, yeah, he's got a good coaching staff there. Use these guys. His job is to manage the game. And if he's comfortable presenting whatever that is, his moments to change a pitcher, how much he's relying on his pitching coach, the one or two maybe slots for pinch hitting, the conversations he's going to have with players, that's managing. So he's not there to coach. He's there to manage.
Well said. And I'm not surprised he's doing well. And obviously he's getting a lot of goodwill in the vault with his players by the way they've started. Mm-hmm. Nothing like having the results pay off quickly as a first-time manager. So they're in a good place, good team. And I like watching them play, Joe. We started talking about hitting. They're a team that does not strike out. They put the ball in play. They don't have a ton of power. They have enough. But if you want to see good fundamental baseball played on the bases, on defense, in the batter's box, Cleveland will give that to you every night. So
everybody can do that, Tommy. Everybody can do that. If I'm telling you, that has to be organizational, philosophically. It's got to start in the minor leagues. You got to pound, pound, pound. You can't turn your head. You got to stay with it. And you have to have teachers, man. I mean, you have to have coaches that, like, I'd always go back to a Larry Bowe. Bowe is not going to tolerate. And, you know, sometimes he might rub you the wrong way, but I love him for that. You have to have coaches that know what they're talking about. They don't tolerate the fact that, no, they don't accept, you know, consistently not doing something correct or right. That's what you need in order to get more contact, better base running. You gotta rub it a little, gotta be a little edgy. Little edgy is not a bad thing.
Yeah, I like that. I think every staff should have one or two guys like that. And that's well said, as usual. It's a lot of fun, Joe. We'll do this again next time. Nice job.
Thanks for stirring me up, brother.
You got it. The Book of Joe podcast is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Do you love Selena?
Like, really love?
Whether you saw her live, saw the movie as a kid, or saw her looks all over TikTok, there's no shortage of reasons to stan the Queen of Tejano.
And stan we do over three whole episodes of our podcast, Becoming an Icon.
We're reminiscing as lifelong Selena fans, sharing hot takes and telling her story. Listen to Becoming an Icon on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Becoming an Icon.
Calling all men. When was the last time you had a really good cry? A recent survey found that women cry on average 5 times a month, while men cry on average only once a month. Studies have shown that crying can support your mental, your physical, and your emotional health. I'm Radhi Devlukia, and on my podcast, A Really Good Cry, we embrace the real, the messy, and the beautiful. Listen to A Really Good Cry on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.